Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. August 30th, 2020. My thoughts on Twitter, August 30th, 2020. The Creator, a force of good, has created the force of evil for us, to reveal him at the conjunction of these two forces instead of at their opposition. Herein lies our long-standing error. The whole universe is one system. With our attitude we calibrate all of nature. We can blow up stars, trigger wars, establish peace. Everything depends solely on our connections. If we want good things for the world, we must establish good relations between us, and the world will be that much better off. The Creator had purposefully broken the law of absolute mutual guarantee so as to give everyone one's own a point of shattering from which one could feel that he exists and attains unity, mutual guarantee. Thus we embody the Creator's name, reveal him, and raise him to reign over all of creation. If I'm willing to give my efforts to the Creator only when I receive pleasure from him, then I am like a woman who sells herself for money. But if I rise above the condition to bestow only if I receive pleasure, then I become a man, I can then even bestow to the Creator. From Twitter, August 30th, 2020. Can society give a person the skills learned in the family? Question. Nature has given us a natural love for children, otherwise we would not be able to create families and raise offspring. Do you think that some organization or state can take on the role of raising children? What would be the result? Answer. Firstly, we have such examples in history, beginning with the Spartan upbringing in ancient Greece and upbringing in special institutions in ancient Rome, which literally spoiled children. In addition, they practiced early conscription into the army, from the age of 10 to 15, where they did whatever they wanted with the children. They grew up very cruel, tough people, who could not create normal families. They lack a sense of empathy to others, and without this, society cannot be created. Question. That is, society cannot replace the skills that the family provides? Answer. No. Up to the present day, we see that people who were not brought up in normal families are different from others. No matter how much they want to start a family, they cannot. After all, we always create a family in some way similar to the one we came from. From Cab TV's The Post-Coronavirus Era, May 21, 2020. Mutual Guarantee, the Law of Nature. Mutual guarantee is a global law of nature, the most important and defining. There is nothing higher than it. The Creator wants the creatures to know this law. And the creation can only attain something through the contrast of opposites. And so the Creator created us, as opposed to mutual guarantee, that is, separated, unconnected, shattered, and full of all forms of egoism. We must rise above these egoistic forces of separation and begin to connect the creation anew. There are 4 degrees in creation that allow you to fully reveal the Creator. In this way they were created by the force of unity, which came out of the Creator and created the 4 stages of direct light. Then they descended further, breaking apart and separating, creating degrees and worlds until they reached this world and turned into all kinds of substances. The substance is broke down further, into molecules, atoms, subatomic and elementary particles. But the main work of man is not to delve into physical or chemical research, into elementary particles, but to connect all the parts of creation on all levels, both physical matter and its spiritual embodiment, into one whole, and to return to the original state from which it was broken. Creation, equivalent in form to the Creator, fully follows the law of mutual guarantee. By the same degrees that the worlds descended, shattered, and divided, creation now rises back up, binds, and connects, first transforming itself from physical material into spiritual. Spiritual matter is one where the law of unity, mutual guarantee, is fulfilled more and more. The separation and descent of the worlds to the very bottom, down to physical matter, was done in order to enable us to bring the entire creation to unity through our own efforts, because one is the name of the Creator. In other words, we need to recreate the law of mutual guarantee between all parts of creation. If we do not do this in time, the process of breakage continues, and we experience more and more new problems and diseases in our lives, that is, separation at all levels, inanimate, vegetative, animal, and human. On the animal level, separation manifests as diseases of the body, on the inanimate and vegetative levels, as natural disasters. The only thing we need is to comply with the law of mutual guarantee. We have only one task: to connect all the parts of creation into a single integrated system, into one, unique and unified, except for whom, there is nothing. This law binds all parts of nature by a simple formula called mutual guarantee, avutt, by which everything exists in perfect harmony. The feeling of this harmony is called the attainment of the Creator by the creation. The Creator has deliberately shattered this law of mutual guarantee in order to give everyone a point of his eye, the point of shattering from which he can feel himself existing and attaining unity, mutual guarantee. This is how we embody the name of the Creator, reveal him, and put him as a king over creation. From the Daily Kabbalah Lesson, August 21, 2020, writings of Balha Sulam, the Avutt, mutual guarantee. The Pyramid of Mutual Guarantee. All the problems and troubles in this world are the result of the revelation of the lack of mutual guarantee, avutt, which is increasing. Therefore, we need our behavior to be correct, to return to even our ordinary material connection and mutual guarantee. All diseases are caused by violations of the law of mutual guarantee at the biological, zoological, botanical, or social level. There are many levels of compliance with the law of mutual guarantee, but the highest is the love of one's neighbor as oneself. In physical and chemical form, substances bind together, and at higher levels, people's thoughts and desires bind together. In this perfect system, which is the universe, all the galaxies are connected to each other, that is, everything depends on the mutual guarantee. The pyramid of mutual guarantee includes at its base the inanimate level, then the vegetative, the animate, and above all, the human level. If we, being above all nature, at the top of the pyramid, fulfill the condition of mutual guarantee, avutt, in our desires and thoughts, in our mind and heart, this will affect all the levels below us. This will calm the whole of nature and bring it back to its integral form. Nature will begin to behave according to the law of mutual guarantee between all its parts in all spheres. And then, of course, we will not have any health problems in the family, in human society, or even in the environment. It is not possible to fix the environment by burning less oil or taking other protective measures, but only by implementing the law of mutual guarantee at the top of the pyramid where we are. By doing this, we will oblige all of nature below us to return to balance, reciprocity, and harmony. The action of physical forces or the interaction of chemical substances according to their valences, according to the number of electrons around the atom, which bind together and build new substances, all these are the laws of mutual guarantee, which are revealed in different forms. All the laws of nature are manifestations of one global law. Even the laws of human relations, psychology, and social life are part of a detailed explanation of the same global law of mutual guarantee, which we must fulfill in its entirety in order to reveal our connection with the Creator within this law. By doing this, we add our part to the Creator, and He adds His to us, and we reach the state of He and His name are one. From the Daily Kabbalah Lesson, August 21, 2020, writings of Balha Sulam, the Avutt, mutual guarantee. The Times of Israel published my new article aiming high at the high Jewish holidays. Images of profound introspection and deeply connected community depict the vivid atmosphere of the days of Or, Yamim Hanoraim, that pack synagogues every fall. This year, for the first time in history, COVID-19 will give a completely different feel to the high holidays because they will be conducted mainly through virtual platforms instead of in massive physical gatherings. The physical distance being imposed upon us is no coincidence. It is a reflection of our internal state as Jewish people. This year's high holidays offer a special opportunity for transformation, to rise from our current division to unity of hearts. Our new conditions are actually an indication and direction from above of what our prayers, particularly during the Jewish holidays, should be about. Now is the perfect time to pause and reflect on our presence in the world as a people, so divided, full of unfounded hatred, without connection or reciprocity. A potent and effective prayer should be the united plea for the whole nation. And how is it possible if we hold each other at arm's length in internal opposition? If this is our state, then we should also feel the distance physically. This is the message inside the unique conditions presented to us by the pandemic this year. It is good for us to feel how much our self-centered games close each of us within ourselves, how hard it is to open the heart toward someone with different opinions, and how much we are divided into factions and parties and camps. We take natural pride in our community and denomination, but it should never be used to belittle, despise, or mistreat others. While our diversity is wonderful, there should be something that connects us all as one above all the different shapes and colors. Currently, we are missing that overarching capstone of love between us. So this year, instead of mechanically congregating, we should sit by ourselves and mourn the splintered and wretched state that we have sunken into as a people. As soon as we realize what must be fixed, our fragmentation as a Jewish nation, a true prayer will burst from the depth of our hearts to breathe life into the empty words recited from the prayer book. Originally, a synagogue, or Beit Knesset, from the Hebrew kinuz, meaning congregating, symbolized a house of connection, a place where everyone gathers together to seek a supreme power of love and giving. If this year the striking circumstances do not even allow us to come together physically, it must be an indication that we have reached a dead end on our current path. But there is a bright side. When the evil is revealed, it provides an invitation to correct the course and chart a new path to a more advanced form of existence. Moreover, the coronavirus era illuminates something that was hidden until now. If in the past we could be separated in our hearts and still sit next to each other, it is no longer so. There is a law in nature which requires us to adapt ourselves to a world that has evolved into a tightly interconnected state. Therefore, we can no longer relate to love thy neighbor as thyself as a lovely but empty platitude. It is the absolute formula for mutual connection, without which it will be impossible to survive. We are entering a new evolutionary degree where everyone will feel that the other is truly a part of him, and we really will become like one man with one heart. The pilot project for integral connection between people must take place first between us, the Jews. And when we crack the new code for connection between us, we will light the way for all other peoples. The end result will be joy, health, prosperity, a supreme abundance that will flow through our connected hearts. Medium published my new article Fate's Punching Bag. No one expected Hurricane Laura to become so catastrophic, just as no one expected the California fires to become so devastating, or that COVID-19 would still be spreading and killing come September. No one also thought that the American economy, which was doing so well, would be stopped in its tracks by the virus, that the job market, which was probably the best ever, would drop to the worst ever in a matter of weeks, or that society would be torn apart by outbursts of racial tensions. No one imagined all these, yet they happened, and are happening still. America is being hit left and right, up and down, and the land of unlimited possibilities seems to have become fate's punching bag. America became great thanks to brave people who dared the odds. But it will remain great only if it dares to tame its own bravado. The United States is evidently a unique country. It did not grow out of a certain tribe or a clan, but formed over time as immigrants from faraway lands migrated, often from dubious circumstances, and landed in a wild no man's land where they could make the rules. And make the rules they did. No one was to touch another's property, or even enter it without permission. If you walked in without permission, you could be shot for trespassing and the law would be on the side of the shooter. But privacy went far beyond property. The settlers in the newly conquered continent determined that no one may tell anyone what to do, think, or say as long as they do not hurt their fellow person. Religion, a formidable inhibitor in Europe, from which the majority of the first settlers came, was declared as one's personal business and therefore lost its punitive power. Everyone was free to pursue one's dream of fame and fortune, and that was indeed the dream for which most Americans lived. In many ways, it still is. For a long time, that dream succeeded. Pursuing it, America became the world's single superpower. Its military might, economic clout, and cultural influence pervaded every corner of the world. Everyone, from America's best friends to its worst enemies, wanted, and perhaps still want to realize the American dream. And that dream is mainly about money and wealth. Bit by bit, America became the leader of the free world, where people were slaves only to the injunctions of their egos. But that could only last so far. At some point, the ego exceeded its limits and began to collapse from within. The society that was built based on the ego could not withstand its increasingly self-centered demands and started to implode. When people began to give up on realizing their dreams, they sought ways to ease their painful disillusionment. Thus, America became a nation of fugitives escaping their own emptiness. Obesity, substance abuse, homicide, suicide, extremism, and any form of escapism became more likely to take root there than anywhere else in the world. Simply, people needed to get away from their hopelessness. Nature, too, of which America was so proud, and rightly so, seems to have joined the trend of bashing America and has been hammering the country on all sides. In its own way, it has said to its settlers, "Enough. Times are changing. The ego is losing steam and has lost its chokehold on the planet. Nature is kicking back, and humanity, the ego's personal thug, is hurting." But America, where the ego wrote the Constitution, hurts the most. In the times to come, mutual consideration will be mandatory, responsibility for one another will be a given, and ego-based cultures will collapse. We are living through a civilizational shift. It is a revolution of a kind we've never seen. It is not a revolution in technology, governance, economics, or in all the above combined. It is a revolution in human nature. Humanity has entered a transformational stage from which it will emerge as a whole new creation, caring, considerate, and united as one. Those who will bury their pride will come out on top. Those who will stand by their egos will fall along with it. America became great thanks to brave people who dared the odds. But it will remain great only if it dares to tame its own bravado. The Germans of the Laws of Moses, Part 4. Another era, another goal. Question: before the Second World War, Germany introduced a lot of restrictions for Jews living there, and still they did not want to leave. Today when I read your posts in which you urge the Jews to unite because otherwise it will be worse for them, I think, if they did not feel anything even then, today it seems ridiculous. On the other hand, I understand why the Jews did not want to come to Israel because it wasn't sweet here either, Arabs, pogroms, dry, barren land. And if you were a successful lawyer or industrialist there, why would you come here? To engage in farming? Answer: We will never be able to understand those times. And for the future it will not help, stop, or teach. Question: what do you hope for when you talk about unification? Do you have a plan? Answer: I have a plan to inspire all Jews in the world to unite among themselves, to show this example to the whole world. We are already living in a completely different era, and not in the one when the Jews had to flee Germany. We don't have to move anywhere today. We need to strive spiritually toward a common goal, toward common unity, and to bring all of humanity along with us. This is a completely different era, a different goal, a different period. For more on this topic, read my books Like a Bundle of Reeds, Why Unity and Mutual Guarantee Are Today's Call of the Hour, and The Jewish Choice, Unity or Anti-Semitism, Historical Facts on Anti-Semitism as a Reflection of Jewish Social Discord. From CabTV's systematic analysis of the development of the people of Israel, August 12, 2019. Health and Medicine, Part 5. Consumer Society, Income and Stress. Question: everyone knows that today two main diseases claim millions of lives, cancer and heart disease. Does it have something to do with our egoistic attitude toward the world? Answer: naturally. Our egoistic attitude toward the world is to take everything away, to take everything into ourselves, to put ourselves above others. It does not give us rest, eats the heart muscle, and upsets the general balance in the body, causing cancer. It is necessary to give a person a normal, calm life, so that he knows why he exists. Why should he work 8 hours a day and stay in traffic jams for another couple of hours? And at home, the children are screaming, the TV is constantly on, and everything else. He is under constant stress, imitating people who are supposedly successful and enjoying life. After all, an ordinary person is very weak, small, and we force him to be macho. Remark: it turns out to be a kind of vicious cycle. On the one hand, you say, don't work, stay at home. But how can I, as a person, not work? Who will feed me tomorrow? The state will not pay me anything. My comment: and where will people live if only 10% of the population works? 90% of the population will have nothing to do. Absolutely nothing. Starting from the 50s of the 20th century, we began to develop technologies, and from the 70s progressed in such a way that almost no additional labor is required. If not for the arms race, we would have found ourselves in a huge crisis long ago. Remark: I think many will agree with you, but today the structure of the state is such that it does not allow a person not to work, since people do not have a certain basic income. My comment: so there will be an income. Now, during the pandemic, half of the population is on furlough. And what can you do if the pandemic continues? Remark: this is the problem. People start to be mentally stressed. My comment: so deal with these stresses. Why should you recreate unnecessary jobs? No one will come and buy at their little shops, hairdressers, and other small businesses. This will not happen. Many industries will die out. And what are you going to do with the vast majority of the population? Where is the real industry? In Russia, beyond the Urals, or in Central America? And everything else is some serving others. But there will be no need for that. Remark: people will participate in sports, go to theaters, watch films. My comment: they won't go to theaters, and they won't participate in sports either. It is enough for them to run a little to warm up on treadmills. How many people go out to engage in sports? It seems to you that there are many of them. I foresee a big problem. The government will have to print money and feed 90% of the unemployed. There is nothing wrong with that. Let's think: how were they fed? One sold to another, and the other one to the next person? Services, services, services. Remark: it is very difficult to get used to the fact that someone will give me a set amount of money. This is already scary. I earned as much as I could. I could earn a lot. My comment, and it was called your work? An illusion was created that you were producing some goods, some services. Remark, no, I made money depending on my abilities. And with this money I could buy pleasure. My comment, and now you will do the same. Remark, but you say, no, they will give you an allowance so that you won't die. My comment, you will be given as much as is necessary for a normal life. And it will be the same for absolutely everyone. There is no other way out. But this is not a critical situation that will pass and something will change. This is the next stage in our development. We will soon see that a huge number of people will receive basic income. In any case, society will end up giving money for a dignified existence. In accordance with this, some will work in production, while others will be engaged in remaking society, in education, upbringing, and the organization of a new society. Question: what will be the health in such a society? Answer: in the morning, people will exercise, go for a swim, each as convenient him or her. I am sure that all this will develop. But precisely for maintaining health, and not for the sake of sports. From Cab TV's The Post-Coronavirus Era, May 14, 2020. The Dominant Desire. Question: can we say that today the desire for self-realization prevails over other desires? Answer: in our generation, we are already turning the pyramid of desires into a circle. Since all nature is integral and is a huge ball in which all levels are connected and support each other, all the aspirations that manifest in humanity take place, whatever they may be. Not only to wealth, entertainment, knowledge, and discovery, but to absolutely everything. We cannot say that the modern stage is characterized by something special in comparison with other periods. The only thing is that now a person begins to develop an attraction to reveal the Creator. In the current generation, the desire for self-realization is more and more evident in the understanding of the main law of the universe. Question: psychologist Abraham Maslow believed that no more than 4% of the human population could reach the highest level of the hierarchy of needs, the desire for self-realization. Moreover, a person feels happy even if the thirst for self-realization is satisfied by only 40%. Do you think that the realization of your potential is the highest point in the pyramid of desires? Answer: naturally, if the realization actually occurs. And if the desire is there, but it is not realized? For example, in our time, many seek not even to know, but to reveal the Creator. Knowledge is open to all, and can be the lot of everyone. But if we are talking about the revelation of the Creator, it is not given to everyone, and therefore, it can no longer be said that a person reaches this state and is happy. From Cab TV's Management Skills, June 25, 2020. How can we raise the point in the heart? Question: how can we raise the point in the heart if it is inside the ego and managed by it? Answer: this point, which is the foundation of our spiritual life, is now held captive by the ego. You must exit your ego by raising your point in the heart above it. However, you do not lose your egoism when you do that. It remains, and you will not be able to remove it in any way. But you can rise above it in order to control it. Question: is there a movement of the point itself inside the ego? Answer: yes. The point in the heart is the foundation of our spiritual vessel, of our soul. But at the same time, it is like a drop of semen from which the embryo develops. Therefore, we must begin to develop it, and it will gradually rise above our ego. The departure of this point from the ego is allegorically called the Exodus from Egypt, the departure from the ruling of Pharaoh, from our egoism. This is the only way we can be free. If we continue to develop the point in the heart, it will grow, and we will begin to feel the spiritual world in it. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, October 7, 2018. New Life 1161. Unity and Government.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Yael Shadael. Hello. And today we'd like to talk about how to lead a country in the spirit of unity. Sometimes, here in Israel and also around the world, we reach a state of a political tie between the political blocks, and we have to build something common in order to lead the nation forward. We want to understand, how should it work? Be with us, Yael, please. Yeah, we're talking about the unity of the nation, of leadership, and in theory, we'd all like for it to happen. But in practice, we see that different political blocks pull in different directions. What really interests them is money, what am I getting out of it, and so on. And we'd like to understand, how should all of it work in the spirit of true unity? And the first question that I'd like to start with is, what should a leadership of unity look like? As it says, that just like their faces are different, so are their desires and thoughts, and in general, there's nothing about one person that's similar to another. And therefore, we understand that there is no unity, and directly, there can be no unity, meaning that people will be similar, and from that, they'll come to unity. No, it doesn't work that way. And also, in a family. Even though that a man and a woman meet, and they have some kind of attraction toward each other, this attraction isn't something exalted in any way, but it's hormones. A normal attraction, what we call love. That each of them loves himself, and each understands that by using the other, I'll be able to fulfill my own desire. So, if there is what we call chemistry between them, that each of them understands that it's good for them to be with another person, because by that, I can delight myself. Then they're attracted to each other, they build a family, and they continue with life, as we know it. But really, life, like we see from life itself, is entirely built on concessions. Only concessions. That on the one hand, the calculation that I make is that I want to be with this person, otherwise I'll have to get divorced. So I want to be with that person. Why? Because we have children, we have a home, we have common property, habits, many things that already tie us together. This is on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have already learned in our common mutual life that in life you have two egoists that in some way keep their distance from each other. Meaning what? That I don't get too much in your space and you don't get too much in my space, but that we're in some kind of game, a kind of dance with each other, trying to do what's pleasant to the other person, and trying not to do things that might offend or hurt the other person, and then this is called that love covers all crimes. That really, we have plenty of disagreements, but we skip over them. We rise above them. There is a very important matter here called play.
That
that I really all the time have to consider the extent to which it's worthwhile benefiting my partner in order for him or her to benefit me in return. And this is how we understand what's beneficial for each of us, and we try doing what's beneficial for the other person, for my partner. There is the matter of habit here, goodwill. There's real acting involved here, like theater, each with his own ego and his own convenience. And this is how we get along. For this, we need lots of intellect, emotion, consent, understanding, and mainly concessions. When we do these things in a family, then it's clear to us that otherwise we won't be able to exist. And nonetheless, we have common property and children and everything, and we're growing older, so what? We'll start it all over again, and what's going to happen the second and third time? And those that do it, where do they have the desire to start it all over again from? The optimism that I'll succeed. I didn't really see that happen. The thing is that the second or third time that they go into a family relationship, they understand that things aren't going to be better, they're going to be the same, or even worse. So they're not as wise as the experienced. So they add their experience and wisdom to this new relationship. And then what follows is that as if the next family they build is one that they can stand. But it's not because the family itself is better than the first one, but because they understood that there's not as wise as the experienced, that things aren't going to be better or really different. And so they stay. The least of two evils, so to speak. If we're talking about a nation or the government, how they should get along together, their things are much harder. They don't feel that they have any common property. The problem in the government, for example, is that they need to build a group that leads the country, and they don't exactly feel that the country is their property. Today it's mine, tomorrow it's his. I don't really care about what I'm leaving for him, on the one hand. On the other hand, I have just one problem to show everyone that I'm right and that I'm good. So, the more the nation, the more that country suffers because of the other person, the better it is for me. Meaning, I don't take into consideration what's good or bad for the country or the nation, but what's good for me. And even if it's to the detriment of the country and the nation, but if by it, I show that I'm greater than that prime minister, or president, or leader, or whoever, that if in his term things got worse for the people, for the country, and with great losses and everything, then I'm content. Meaning, it's really, really different, usually, than how it is in a family, because a family has property and children and things, and there, one way or another, we somehow continue to be interdependent if you have your children and property and a home, and it's not simple to play at the expense of each other. Therefore, the difference is vast. And as if it's much easier to take care of a family. There, the damage is personal, Whereas the government doesn't have these kinds of problems, and therefore there we can really go wild. And what happens? To this day we still remember the Antalena and all the problems that we had back then, even though so much time went by already. And the way we accepted immigrants from different countries, and how it was all controlled by the ego of the representatives of the nation in those days. Meaning here the calculation is much cruder, more egoistic, false, that you have no court that can discuss these matters and say which of the couple is wrong, which isn't, and how to divide the roles and property between them and so on. It's a problem. So, if suppose we're talking about the attitude of, suppose, some of the parties about how they manage the country, I wouldn't allow any of the parties to manage. Because really, we never saw that there's any party of peace, because none of them was brought up correctly to be that way, to see the nation as one, the country as one, the benefit and well-being of the country above everything, and can even concede his position, respect, and everything that comes with it, and is not yelling, "Let me lead, let me drive, give me the wheel," like little children that want to hold the wheel. And so that's the problem. Not only here, only that here we're all the time in a critical situation. We're always on the borderline between existing and not existing, succeeding or, God forbid, who knows what. And therefore, from what I understand, according to the wisdom of Kabbalah, not according to my own nature, but according to what I learn from the wisdom of Kabbalah, we have no chance of succeeding but under a national unity government. But a national unity government consisting of those that really want unity, that are capable of it, that are capable of concessions, like in family life, that each and every family is all in all concessions, that everyone concedes something, annulling him or herself toward the other person. So, a national unity government is one that includes many opposite forces, opposing forces, and it's a must. It's not one party, that's not good, because then they pull the entire nation and the entire country in a certain direction, and it always arises discontent in the nation. And we already saw how the socialists that ran the country until 1977 or 8, I think, until the Likud party came to power for the first time, what they did, what they wanted, how they built here everything, the HMO and the banks and the labor union and so on, that afterwards it was hard to somehow bring it to balance with the other forces. I think that actually several strong parties should participate in this, that are really different, not just that they have different names. I Unfortunately, I don't see strong parties that are different. Today you have Kahol Lavan and Likud, these two parties. I don't think that anyone understands what's the difference, the differences that here. Netanyahu wants to rule, and there Gantz wants to rule, together with Lapid and maybe someone else. So all in all, it's a matter of a leader that thinks that he knows how to manage things and he really wants to. So it's not exactly what I'm talking about. A good, proper government is one that consists of opposite forces, and they know how to connect with one another and how to get out of the oppositeness the good, correct results in each and every moment and for every question. This is called a national unity government, that the unity is that they want to the benefit of the country. And there are disputes, differences in opinion, and different things, of course. But everyone understands that only by the spirit of unity will they be able to do something good for the state and for the people. Therefore, a national unity government is one that consists of opposite forces that know and understand, that are wise enough to manage themselves toward unity. And not to delude ourselves that one party can properly run the country. It's not good. But actually several opposite parties that along with it also know how to reach unity, connection. How does such a government work? What does it think? What does it feel? What goes on there? How does it work? Well, it's also like in a family, that you have two people, that maybe each of them thinks differently, but because they have a common goal, then they have to discuss each and every detail of that goal and to see how can they reach a preferable result for both, by the one, by the other, and maybe by both, that there are concessions, completion, but this is how they work. This is what they work on daily. And how do you deal with serious ideological gaps? Today, no party has any ideology. There's only the matter of how to destroy the other and control everything. That's the ideology. It's not like in the past that you had ideologists and parties that had a certain philosophy about life, certain perception. Today you don't have that. Today it's only about money and power. Crony capitalism, that's it. I want to add another aspect. Up until now, we talked about the leadership, the government itself, but there's also the public. If at some point in Israel or in any other place, truly a national unity government will come to power that consists of opposing views, that they rise above in concession, what spirit will it bring? That everything is to the benefit of the nation and the country, that everything is to their benefit, that they really come to serve and not to succeed and rule and build something special for each of them. And suppose they really did connect into one government the way you mean it, and they're really concerned with the general interest of the country and the public, like in a family. And really there's the spirit of concession and everything. What's transmitted? What kind of energy, or how is it absorbed by the public? What will it do to us as a society? We will feel that they are working to our benefit. We will feel that someone cares for us. We'll get an explanation about why are they doing things one way or another. We as a nation need for the government to come and give account for what it does, and that it's to the benefit of the people and the country, children, women, families, and so on. I want to clearly know this. Otherwise, what are they there for? To share the cake between them. The disunity that exists in the leadership also exists in the nation. Will it somehow affect the general spirit of the nation? Will the nation become less disputed as a result of the leadership being more united? Of course, the nation will take an example from the government. How complete strangers that even oppose each other, that are even hostile toward one another, how they rise above that for the sake of a better solution for their common property, which is the country. Does it really have such a strong impact? Because many say that the leadership is corrupt, bad, so the nation actually imitates what happens there. And there is a perception that says that, no, we all behave the same way, the public and the government. Yeah, but we see that nothing good can come from that. Nothing good comes from their egoistic, short-sighted behavior, neither for the people, for the country, for any family, for no one. Why should we even think about that? We're supposed to get an example from our so-called leaders as to how should we behave among us. You're saying that this example from the leadership will permeate to the public. They have to explain it all the time. Why are they doing things one way or another, these laws and not those? They have to set an example for the right behavior for the public. Our time's almost up. Still, if you can summarize what you taught us up until now, a leadership in the spirit of connection, what is there about it? There are opposing forces there that, one way or another, their goal is the well-being of the country and the public, and in favor of that, they act, work together. And in their mutual concessions, maybe they see different means and a different state at the end, but this is what they discuss all the time, and only through completion, mutuality, can they reach the right result. We wish. Thank you very much, Dr. Lightman. Thank you, Yael. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.
Parting with the ego. Question: how can I die in order to be born correctly? Answer: very simple, tell your ego, die. Or I'll bust your chops. Question: does a Kabbalist regret his death? Answer: a Kabbalist does not die. I have often told you about how Rabash used to compare a person's body to a shirt that a person takes off and throws into the laundry basket. Here too, a person takes off his wrapping and throws it into the laundry basket, and continues to exist naked and clean of the ego. Question: but this is only if I adhered to the eternal during my lifetime, to my point in the heart. Answer: of course, and if you did not manage to adhere, you have to undergo other states. But still, there is no death, only parting with our egoism. In reality, we can do that while still living in our world. If we don't, we will seemingly have to die in our beastly body in order to part with the ego. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, July 10, 2018.